Let's generate our motivation. I was telling someone recently that one of my teachers used to always tell us, have a happy mind. And I remember being quite befuddled by that, because he usually said that in response when I came to asking for some advice because my mind was unhappy. And just saying, have a happy mind, was like, well, if I could do that, I wouldn't be asking for help right now. But I've thought about what he said over the years, and it's come to mean something to me. And I'll share that with you. But I think as I contemplate it even more, it will have more meaning for me. So keep a happy mind doesn't mean give yourself chocolate and do what you like and don't do what you don't feel like doing. What it came to mean to me is don't make a big deal out of things. Don't make your own mind unhappy by getting upset over things that are not worthy of getting upset over. So in other words, to really watch the mind, and when the mind is starting to make a big deal, either getting attached to someone or something, thinking that they're quite wonderful and being with them will really fulfill our needs, or being angry and resentful, again, exaggerating the negative qualities and painting a horrible picture and then getting all turbulent inside because of it. So when my mind is engaged of either of those or other varieties of them, to press the pause button, to just recognize that I'm in the process of making myself miserable by following an affliction or by helping an affliction to arise. And so to quit doing that to myself, turn my mind to something more valuable that will make the mind happy, that will make the mind peaceful, instead of stirring it up ignorantly with craving and resentment. So if we really make an effort to keep our mind happy, then when different external things go on, we don't get bent out of shape. Our mind is more balanced, more even. And that makes our whole life a lot easier. And it makes it so much easier on other people to be around us too. And needless to say, learning to pacify our mind in that way makes generating bodhicitta easier. And holding that altruistic intention makes the mind quite inspired and joyful. So let's dedicate that right now. Our generate that right now as our motivation for this evening. You think you can keep a happy mind? Yeah. It's really up to us, isn't it? It's very much up to us. Because we can take the smallest thing and get attached to it, and we can take the smallest thing and get upset about it. All by our little old selves. I had 4 hours of sleep last night. So I'm not going to guarantee the quality of this teaching. But I'll try, and maybe you have to listen closely to correct any mistakes I make. So in my records, we left off talking about what he's calling an uncertain consciousness. Is that what you have? Okay. So usually it's called doubt, but he calls it uncertain. That's okay. It's just different translation terms according to different people's preferences. So the definition of an uncertain consciousness in general is a knower that has qualms with regard to its own object. So it's called a knower. A knower is a mind that's supposed to ascertain something. But I don't know if this one doesn't really ascertain. It's mostly in confusion. Okay, and it has qualms. It's uncertain about its own object. So it says there's three kinds. Yeah. And they are the next three on the list of seven. So what was the first one? Wrong consciousnesses. Okay. So again, the way he's making the list of seven is not the usual way. It comes in the Lowrig texts. But this way is quite effective for really showing how you go from a wrong consciousness to a direct perceiver that is a reliable consciousness. Okay, so there's three divisions. First is an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual, like a two-pointed mind thinking sound is probably permanent. Okay, so sound is definitely impermanent. This mind is inclined towards the wrong conclusion. It's not certain that sound is permanent, like a wrong consciousness is, but it's leaning in that direction. Okay. Can you think of an example of this kind of doubt or this kind of uncertain consciousness that you've had?
Mm-hmm. My old belief that life ended after death.
Mm. Yeah. So was that a wrong consciousness, or were you uncertain but inclined towards that?
There was a lot of doubt, but I was inclined towards believing.
Yeah.
That light, like a candle, life is over.
Yeah, it's over, finished, finito. Yep. That's a very good example. Okay. Then, yeah. Then the second one is an equivocating uncertain consciousness. So that one wavers between believing something that is not factual and believing something that is factual. Like a hesitating consciousness which wonders whether sound is permanent or impermanent. So, yeah, it's got to be permanent or impermanent. I'm not sure which one it is. Okay. Can you think of an example from your own experience?
My wavering when I was around 10 to 12 around the belief in God and a soul.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, because that was how I'd been raised, going to church, but I was really wavering either side of like, this makes no sense, but this is the worldview that I've been raised in, and struggling a lot with that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's a good example. I just had one pop in my mind. We did a skit some years ago, right before Thanksgiving, about the turkeys that sit on the fence. Yeah, do you remember what the skit was about? Yeah, so to ordain or not to ordain, that is the question. Okay? And so people get really stuck. Yeah, should I ordain? Should I not? Should I? Shouldn't I? You know? And then they just stay in this incredible, miserable state of vacillation. Okay? Then the third one is an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is factual. So it's still a two-pointed mind. For example, thinking sound is probably impermanent. So you're still not sure, but you're going in the right direction. Somebody think of an example?
When I first met the Dharma, thinking maybe there's rebirth. I don't know, but I knew for sure I wasn't in believing in a creator God. So it was, then that seemed to be the other logical option, but yeah. Not sure.
Yeah, but more inclined towards that. So if we look in our experience closely, there's probably a lot of things in the process of becoming a Buddha, Buddhist. they're not the same things, but... where we might have started out with the wrong consciousness, gone to the doubt, inclining towards the wrong conclusion, then the middle doubt, then the doubt, inclining towards the right one. Okay. So this is quite natural, you know, when you first hear the teachings and it really challenges your old beliefs, then you start thinking like this and your mind kind of goes through these stages of uncertainty. Yeah. And, let's go on. Then we'll see what happens after that. These three are listed in a graded series from the least reliable, tending to believe something that is not true, to the more reliable, tending to believe something that is true. Okay? Uncertain consciousnesses in general, and each of the three types are 3P with consciousnesses, consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing objects, mental consciousnesses, and conceptual consciousnesses. They are all mutually exclusive with sense consciousnesses and non-conceptual consciousnesses. So why are they mutually exclusive with sense consciousnesses and non-conceptual consciousnesses? They are... All sense consciousnesses are valid cognizers?
They're all direct perceivers.
They're all direct, but direct perceivers are unmistaken. When they define direct perceivers, it fits the definition. Well, the first moment. Yeah, the first moment fits. Okay, so why can't doubt be a sense cognizer? Yeah. Why?
Because it's not directly apprehending an object at all, actually.
Yeah. It's thinking about something.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's thinking about something, and because its appearing object is a conceptual appearance, therefore it can't be a direct perceiver. Okay. Now he said that it's 3P with consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing objects. So go through that and see if what he said is true. Yeah. Is there something that's both doubt or an uncertain consciousness and a consciousness mistaken with regard to its appearing object? Yeah. Example? Yeah, give an example of a specific doubt.
Like, for instance, doubt thinking that sound is permanent.
Okay. So why is that one a consciousness that's mistaken with respect to its appearing object?
Because the appearing object is a conceptual appearance, and it's a doubting consciousness because it's knower with qualms that with regard to its own object.
Yeah. Okay. And then is there something that is doubt that is not a consciousness mistaken with respect to its appearing object? And is there something that's an appearing that is mistaken with respect to its appearing object but is not doubt? Yeah, example?
The subject, wrong consciousness.
Yeah. Okay, so wrong consciousness. And is there something that's neither?
A direct perceiver that is a visual consciousness apprehending red.
Okay. Okay, so you feel okay about all your doubts?
I'm sure.
Yeah?
And what actually is the appearing object of a doubt?
Well, it's definitely a conceptual appearance. Okay. And then what is it? It's probably changing, you know, back and forth between two different things. You know, because it's this, and then it's that. It can't settle on one or the other. But some people say if it's mistaken with respect to its appearing object, then it doesn't really have an appearing object. Yeah, so there's different ways that people explain that, okay? So the first of these three is an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual. Here, the belief is not decisive like a wrong consciousness. A wrong consciousness, you are sure, you know? There's a stubbornness. And, of course, we're totally wrong, and we're totally stubborn. Yeah, and that shows the depth of our ignorance. Yeah, that we're wrong, and we won't even let in our mind the chance that we're wrong. Yeah, we're sure we're right. So wrong consciousness, big problem. Doubt is going a little bit in the right direction, but again, doubt immobilizes us. We can't act. Yeah, when there's doubt in the mind, we're just stuck. And you see many people in their life, you know, in terms of what they believe, they can't figure out one thing or another. And in terms of making decisions about what to do, they can't make a decision of what to do. You know, if I do this, then I'll miss out on doing that. But if I do that, I'll miss out on doing this. Yeah. And so then they don't do either, and they miss out on doing both. Yeah. But there's so much fear of, you know, making the wrong decision that, you know, they choke themselves. They can't do anything. Yeah, it's a problem. Yeah?
If we start out with a wrong consciousness, though, then doubt can actually be a good thing because we could start progressing towards the correct assumption.
Sure, yeah. But doubt is definitely a negative state. There's degrees of negativity. You don't want to stay in doubt. Yeah, because, I mean, you're totally stuck, aren't you? Yeah. And then you wait, and you want somebody to tell you what to do. And then somebody tells you, and you say, don't tell me what to do. I don't like that idea. And you go to somebody else, and you say, tell me what to do. And you know, you find people who do this. They go from one lama to the next until one of them tells them what they want to hear. Okay. But they're kind of stuck in doubt, except they know what they want to hear. They basically waste everybody's time. Yeah. And then, they get some advice, whatever advice. Yes, but... Yeah, instead of really thinking about the advice clearly and making a clear decision, you know, staying. People with such a doubting consciousness, that is the first one, probably think such and such is the case when actually it is not the case. Yeah, like, yeah, probably like a lot of us were after the election. What? What? No, this can't be happening. Okay, and in the second one, he introduced all three types of doubt, but the second of the seven is actually the doubt inclined towards the wrong decision. Okay, then the third, an equivocating, uncertain consciousness, wavering between believing something that is not factual and believing something that is factual. Okay, so this second type of uncertain consciousness, the third on the list of seven, is a two-pointed mind that is wavering equally between yes and no. This sort of consciousness is a slight improvement over the previous one, an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual, because it has trended away from the wrong decision. None of these types of uncertain consciousnesses is decisive, but this type is not coming close to any decision, neither favoring one side nor the other. So you have a two-pointed needle, and the needles are the same length. Okay. The improvement is that you're not leaning towards the wrong decision. People with such an equivocating, uncertain consciousness think, perhaps so and such is the case, and perhaps it is not. So this afternoon, I went to give something to Venerable Sumpton in the office, and she asked me about, you know, because we came back from Asia, and she asked me about carrying cash into the U.S., and then explained to me that, you know, because they say you can carry unlimited amount, but you have to declare it if it's over 10K. And then she told me that that they have dogs now that can sniff the cash. And she read a story of somebody whose money was seized by the Border Patrol. So I had doubt, you know. So, okay, sniffing the cash sounds weird, but how can a dog tell the difference between a $100 bill and a $5 bill? Okay? You know, can a dog really do that? So I'm in a state of doubt inclined towards the wrong decision. And then she sent me an article, you know, about some people in the Netherlands who train dogs to sniff out cash. Yeah. And I kind of went into the doubt in the middle at that point. It kind of sounds weird, but I'm not sure. And then, so then I looked it up on the U.S. border, Customs and Border Patrol. And yes, they do train dogs to sniff cash. Yeah. And they found one man, he was going to Ghana, and he was taking like $143,000 with him and didn't declare it. And so they seized it. Okay. So then I went to doubt inclined towards the right conclusion, but I still don't understand how the dog can tell the difference between a $5 bill and a $100 bill. Or maybe the dog just smells a lot of bills, and then it's up to the custom official to see if they're $5 or $100.
Yeah. It's like having a bouquet of flowers. You can have a bouquet with only one flower in it, and you can have a bouquet with tons of flowers. So the smell will be different. Big amount, small amount. Uh-huh. So they would smell. But I'm sure the dog don't say, oh, there's $73,000 in there.
Yeah. Maybe he counts it out with his paw.
You just smell a bigger amount.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm still on a doubt inclined towards the wrong decision. I'm kind of inching towards an assuming consciousness. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder if, if the cash is handled by a lot of people, it's going to smell different than if it's fresh. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, it was interesting. Just on things like this, you kind of watch how your mind changes, and how you hear certain things, and your mind's totally incredulous. It's like, no way. And then how you begin to digest it after a while. Yeah, it sounds like right now Congress is stuck in the doubt, going one way and the other. Are we going to pass a bill? Are we going to shut down the government, or aren't we? Are we going to pass down a bill or pass out a bill or not? And it sounds like Trump was kind of in the middle, and now he's, going towards being more certain that he's going to veto it. So you can see, the uncertain mind is not stable. Yeah, it changes like this. So it's a very unreliable mind. So this is good to remember, that when our mind is vacillating, it may not be so wise to make an important decision. It might be better to do more learning, more investigation, and gain more information. Yeah, so we can make a good decision. Okay, then the fourth one is an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is factual. So this third type of uncertain consciousness, the fourth on the list of seven, is a two-pointed mind that is leading toward believing something that is real. Still, this belief is not at all decisive, and it can be reversed. It is just leaning in one direction. In this case, a person tends to believe something that is accurate, but the belief may not be held strongly, and the person still does not really know. Yeah. So a person may also here kind of be inclined towards the right conclusion, but have the wrong reason for being inclined towards that conclusion. No, I mean, you can have an assuming consciousness that's like that, but here even doubt going towards the right conclusion, you can be toying with it because of the wrong reason. Yeah, just because you have a good conclusion doesn't mean you really understand the object or have the right reason for it. So this is like the case of a scientific theory that is still unproven, but eventually turns out to be right. So this is what's interesting. You may have a scientific theory, okay? So it might be something correct, but if you don't know it's correct, then your consciousness isn't a correct correct consciousness, okay? So just the fact that the belief is correct doesn't, how to say, if you have a correct belief, but you don't have it for the wrong reason, or you don't understand why you have it, or you're leaning towards that correct belief, but again, for the wrong reason or for no reason at all, it's not a very trustworthy consciousness. Yeah. And in fact, it's maybe it's one of those consciousnesses where we say ignorance is bliss. Yeah. Because you don't really know the reason and you're inclined towards something. Okay. So then the fifth one is a correctly assuming consciousness. Yeah, I'm at number four. Okay. So an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is factual. So the third type of uncertain consciousness, the fourth on the list of seven, is a two-pointed mind that is leaning towards believing something that is real. Still, this belief is not at all decisive. I read this already, didn't I? Okay, yeah, so it's the case of a scientific theory that is still unproven, but eventually turns out to be right. This sort of consciousness is, again, a slight improvement over the previous one, an equivocating uncertain consciousness, because it is trending towards the right decision. People with this type of uncertain consciousness think probably such and such is the case, and their belief is concordant with the fact. But it doesn't really help them that their belief is concordant with the fact, because they still can't act on it. Okay, then the fifth one is the correctly assuming consciousness. So we have a lot of these. Well, we have a lot of the first four, too. Okay, we like to think we don't. Okay, we like to think that all of our consciousnesses are inferences and reliable direct perceivers. But unfortunately, we are deluding ourselves. Yeah, so that belief in that we have about our own consciousnesses is a wrong consciousness. Okay. So five, a correctly assuming consciousness is one that is correct in its assumption, but it is still a belief and not knowledge. This consciousness makes an assumption that is concordant with the fact, and though the person may have been trained to get this level of understanding, it is not based on either full experience or reasoning. For instance, when something has been explained to you, as you continue to think about it and try to complete your understanding, that is correct assumption. Much of what we say or know is actually correct assumption. So I'm thinking of when you go to school and you're studying something in a class and you study for the exam, yeah, and you tell the professor what the professor already knows. Yeah. So what kind of, you can get a good mark by doing that, just repeating the words. But what level of consciousness is it? Yeah. Your mind could actually be doubting that, but you say it because you know that that's the answer you're supposed to give. Or your mind can be a correct assumption and have really no idea what the statement means. But again, you've memorized it and you know that you're supposed to say that. So it's really a question for us, you know, whether we're studying in secular subjects or in Dharma, yeah. How well do we really understand what we're studying? Because knowing the words, yeah, we could still even have a wrong consciousness, even though we know the words. Okay. So we're going in the right direction, but still we can be a really long way from actual understanding something. Okay, so here's the definition of a correct assumption, or correct assumer would be better. A knower that does not get at an object with respect to which superimpositions have been eliminated, although it adheres one pointedly to the phenomena which is its principal object of engagement. Okay, so it has an object of engagement, its principal object of engagement. Okay, it adheres to that object. It believes that object, but it hasn't eliminated superimposition. So it doesn't understand completely why it believes in that object. Okay? So you have the correct conclusion, but the mind behind that conclusion doesn't really understand. Do you understand what I'm saying now? Are you in doubt? Are you in wrong consciousness? Or are you spaced out, not even paying attention? Yeah.
Is it like a professor who teaches Buddhism but does not practice, does not really believe in it?
Yeah. Well, again, there can be a professor who teaches Buddhism but doesn't practice it, and a professor who teaches Buddhism who does not really believe in it. And those are two different people, okay? Because the person, the first one, can teach it and believe it but just not practice. Whereas the other one could teach it, doesn't believe it, and probably wouldn't practice. Okay. So this is why I personally prefer to study from people who practice, because chances are you'll hear something more correctly from someone who, you know, hopefully. That person who practices would have a deeper understanding. Okay, so getting at an object would mean that the consciousness has actually grasped it, understood it, realized it, engaged with it, and knows it as it is. Okay, so this is a knower that does not get at an object. Okay, so it doesn't really get what it's talking about. Although it can know the words very well. A correctly assuming consciousness is definitely trending in the right direction, but it has not fully grasped its object. Such a consciousness has eliminated superimpositions with respect to its object. Okay, so a consciousness that fully understands it has eliminated those superimpositions. So a superimposition or a superimposing consciousness is one which adds on something with respect to its object of engagement, as, for example, a thought apprehending sound as permanent or apprehending the mental and physical aggregates as a substantially existent self. So here's something where I disagree with what he's saying a little bit. Because superimposition usually means you're adding on something that isn't there. Then there's also denigration, is that the word? Where you're denying something that is there. So what he's saying, the word superimposition, but the way he's defining it, or the examples he's giving, I should say, are examples also of denigration. Usually they're taught as two separate things. Okay? So when we are talking about emptiness, for example, Yeah, you have the conventionally existent object. Superimposition on that is saying that it's truly existent. Denigration is going to the other extreme of nihilism and saying there's nothing that exists.
Deprecation.
What?
Deprecation.
Deprecation. Yeah, that's it, deprecation. I knew it was a D, one of those D words, you know. Okay, yeah, so you're deprecating the object. Okay, so he's just saying superimposition, but the example he gave are two, because apprehending sound as permanent would be deprecation. Apprehending the mental and physical aggregates as a substantial self is superimposition. Okay? Do you understand? Hello? Yeah? What don't you understand? Are those two words, do you want me to explain them again?
Yeah.
Okay. So superimposition is, yeah, there's a cup here, and I add something on top of it. Okay. So the cup is here, and I say, this is the most beautiful cup in the world. Okay. This cup is truly existent. This cup is, you know, mine forever. I'm adding something that isn't there on the cup. Yeah. Deprecation is the cup is there, and I'm saying, you know, that cup is just an illusion. There's actually nothing there at all. Okay? So it's like the opposite of superimposition. Yeah. So these two come a lot as a pair, yeah, when we're studying.
How is saying sound is permanent a deprecation? I don't understand.
How is saying it's permanent? Because it's impermanent, yeah, and you're denying something that it is. Okay.
You're
superimposing permanence on impermanence?
On the sound.
On the sound. I see it more as you're denigrating the sound. Mm-hmm. But in either case,
it does seem like you're doing both. You're denying its momentariness.
You're denying its momentariness. Mm-hmm. And you're projecting a non-momentariness onto
yeah.
it.
But if you use the example of emptiness, yeah, isn't saying it's totally non-existent. You could say, oh, well, that's adding something too. It's adding non-existent. But they never call saying it's non-existent a superimposition. They call that a deprecation.
Permanence okay. is a quality and non-existence is not a quality. Hmm? Permanence
is a quality of an object. And non-existence is just an absence of quality. You could look at the two words that way. I usually see impermanence as the presence of a quality. You know, there's something present, change. And I see permanence as a lack of that change. Anyway, we get the point. And it just depends how we're defining the words there, how we're seeing those two words. Okay, so these add-ons or superimpositions are not true to the phenomena. To think that sound has the quality of permanence or that the aggregates are a substantially existent person is to believe in something that has just been added on or superimposed by conceptuality. These superimpositions cannot be understood as true to the phenomena. So if a consciousness does not eliminate superimposition with respect to its object, it could not get at that object and could not realize it. Okay. Still, the correctly assuming thought adheres one pointedly to its ascertainment. But it hasn't ascertained the object. Okay. It is decisive about the two-pointed wavering that uncertain consciousnesses have. It is decisive without the two-pointed wavering that uncertain consciousnesses have. Naturally, since the thought is consistent and additional information continues to support that thought, we often imagine that we know the object of thought. Okay, so that is something important to remember. Okay, yeah. So we have this belief. Everything we check on seems to reinforce that belief. And so we think that we've actually apprehended the object correctly, but we still haven't really gotten at it. We still haven't decisively eliminated superimpositions, or I would say deprecations about it. Yeah. And so the correct assumer can still change. Yeah. It's decisive in a wishy-washy way. Yeah. Sometimes we're equally stubborn about our correct assumptions. Yeah. And we refuse to hear any other information. But we still haven't really understood it. Okay, here's an alternate definition. A mind newly and one-pointedly determining its own true object, which is devoid of either the two ascertainments, that is, does not actually eliminate superimpositions in dependence on either the power of experience or a reason that is its basis. That one needs a few readings. A mind which is newly, I don't know why it has to be new, but he says newly, and one-pointedly determining its own true object, which is devoid of either the two ascertainments. So the which actually modifies the mind. It doesn't modify the object. Okay? So the mind is devoid of either the two ascertainments, not the object. Yeah. Okay. That is, that mind does not actually eliminate superimpositions in dependence on either the power of experience or reason that is its basis. Okay. This definition specifies that a correctly assuming consciousness is a thought, okay, that is not eliminated superimpositions in dependence on the power of experience or a reason that gave rise to understanding. Okay, so here are two possible ways of engaging with the object that could transform it from a correct assumer into an inference, okay, or a direct perceiver. So, which is either experience or a correct reason. But this belief lacks experience and a correct reason, okay? It may have wrong experience. It may have a wrong reason, okay? But it's lacking something, okay? Excluding that the thought arose in dependence on experience, okay, makes clear that such a consciousness is not a direct perceiver. Because if that consciousness were a direct perceiver, then experience could verify it. Okay, and excluding that it arose in dependence on a reason that gave rise to the understanding makes clear that it is not an inferential cognizer. Okay, because it didn't arise in dependence on a reason. So those two eliminate, the first one eliminates that it's a direct reliable cognizer, the second one eliminates that it's an inferential reliable cognizer. Okay? These specifications serve to set off correctly assuming consciousnesses from the last two on the list of seven. Note that this definition does not say that superimpositions have not been eliminated, which would contradict the earlier definition. This definition does not say that superimpositions have not been eliminated, but the previous definition does say that superimpositions have not been eliminated. Okay. Yeah. So it does not say it, which because that would contradict the earlier definition. Rather, okay, this definition does not say that superimpositions have not been eliminated. So that doesn't mean that it does say that superimpositions have been eliminated, but it does not say that they haven't been eliminated. But the previous definition did say they haven't been eliminated. So not saying that superimpositions have not been eliminated would contradict the earlier definition. He needs an editor. Rather, it says that they have not been eliminated by experience or reasoning. Oh, I see what it's saying. Okay, so the person could have a correct assumption, yeah, which is does not contain any superimpositions, but it has not eliminated superimpositions through experience or reasoning.
I think reasoning there is assuming that you're talking about inference, because mm-hmm. a correct assumption could have a reason. And it could be a correct reason, it just hasn't proven that reason yet.
So yeah.
It could be relying on reasoning, but it hasn't brought it to fruition to be a reliable cognizer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Rather, it says that they have not been eliminated by experience or reasoning.
But they have been eliminated.
Yeah. Yeah, with a correct reasoning, you could say that they have been eliminated, but not through experience or reasoning.
That's why it's not stable enough to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond a belief.
Yeah. But the previous definition says the superimpositions have not been eliminated. Oh, no, it does. It says that. Yeah, knower that does not get at an object with respect to which superimpositions have been eliminated. The not was earlier in the sentence. Okay. It's good when you get confused, then you have to go back and figure it out. Okay. So, divisions. There are three types of correctly assuming consciousnesses. So the first one, a correctly assuming consciousness without a reason. Okay? Like an awareness that thinks sound is impermanent without any reason at all. Okay? So there we can see that superimpositions have been eliminated but not by experience or reasoning. Okay. In other words, you heard, oh, sound is impermanent, and you say, sounds good. Yeah, I believe that. But you haven't really thought about why is it impermanent. So you haven't, when you hear or heard a gong, really listened and thought, oh, that sound is changing every moment. And you haven't, that would be experience, and you haven't really thought, oh, the sound is a product of causes, therefore it's also not permanent. It's impermanent. Okay? So it's a correctly assuming consciousness without a reason. Yeah, just sounds good. So we have a lot of those kind of consciousnesses, don't we? Yeah. I mean, we hear people say all sorts of things, and we just say, sounds good, and we believe it. Yeah. And we haven't really checked out all the information. And it's such that now that with, you know, it's almost impossible for us to check out the veracity of all the information that we hear. Yeah, because we hear so much and we don't have the skills to investigate each one of those things. Yeah. Like today somebody was, what was he saying at lunchtime? That if you exercise, it can prevent dementia from coming 9 years earlier than it normally would have come. So if you get aerobic exercise, what was it, maybe 3 times a week, they weren't sure, that it can prevent dementia from coming like 9 years earlier than it would come, okay? So, yeah, and somebody says, I read a study that says this. So now what do you do with that information? Do you treat it as, okay, well, my friend doesn't lie, and they quoted a study, and usually studies are done by professionals, and they don't lie, so it must be true. Yeah, so is that how you think? Why not?
There's many studies out there that are really erroneous and not conducted properly, and the principals have a agenda and they push that forward, or it's based on them getting more funding, all kinds of things. So you have to go to the study and evaluate the methods. And,
yeah,
you know, maybe they say this is true, and they did. They had an N of 2 people.
So, yeah,
you know, yeah,
right. Yeah, so you really have to evaluate the study, but then you have to know enough about how to evaluate studies to draw the correct conclusion, and you have to know statistics. And then you also have to know the field that the study was done in. So how many of us know all of that? So, you know, people tend to believe whatever they read.
Fake news.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but we read it, we believe it, we make these assumptions, and it could be completely wrong for the reasons that she gave. Yeah, I earned my way through my last 2 years of college working on research projects at the university. That shattered my belief in the scientific method. Yeah, just because I saw, you know, you try and control all the variables. You cannot. There's no way you can control all the variables, even though the studies say, now, oh, it's been controlled for all these variables, blah, blah, blah. It's impossible to do that. Yeah? So it's presented. You're in science. You're nodding your head in agreement. Yeah? Yeah. And yet, you know, if it's somebody who is from a specific university or whatever, yeah, then we believe. But like you said, I mean, they could be affiliated with a pharmaceutical company. They could be on the payroll of who knows who.
And when I hear something new, I tend to compare it to what I already know.
Yeah.
Like, does this kind of fit with what I've read elsewhere? But that's not fail-proof either.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we often tend to do, compare it with what we already know. But what we already know may be wrong. I mean, when you look about how they talked about atoms and molecules when I was, you know, in sixth grade, which is when I learned about them, or maybe fourth grade or whenever it is, you know, now they talk about subatomic particles in a totally different way. Yeah. So part of us, I see this also in Dharma too, that whatever people learn at the beginning, even if it's wrong, they tend to hold on to it. Yeah. Because that's what you learn at the beginning. It's your first introduction. You hold on to it. Yeah. Even though, you know, in science, you know, they may discover something new. In Dharma, you may have learned that from, you know, the chai shop guru who only took one course more than you've taken and, you know, has it all confused. And then a teacher who's learning tells you how it actually is, and you don't believe it because it contradicts what you already knew. That's called being closed-minded. Yeah, although we don't often think of it that way. Okay, so it's interesting, you know, when we really think, how much do we actually know? You know, where the superimposition has been eliminated. Not so much. You know, how we form our worldviews. Yeah, so much is correct assumption, isn't it? I remember one time, at our summer course at Deer Park, somebody raised the question, well, what about a university professor who teaches emptiness and understands the syllogism, you know, the self, the I is empty of inherent existence because it's a dependent arising. Does that person have a correct inference? Yeah. And they brought that up as a topic of discussion. And I was going, what? You know, it's like, that person's not going to have a correct inference. Yeah. Because if you have a correct inference, it completely changes how you look at things. You know, there's something very strong about it. Whereas, you know, we all say, oh, yeah, the self is empty because it's a dependent arising. You know, we say all these things, but do we live like we believe it? No, we live like we believe that the self, you know, truly exists. The same way we talk about karma. Oh yes, karma is so important to follow because all of our experiences depend on our own actions. Yeah, we say that. As Buddhists, for years we say it. Do we live as if we really believe that? No. You know, once the opportunity comes to benefit ourselves, our understanding of karma is out the window. Yeah. And attachment and craving win the day. Okay. So, you know, we're getting there having a correct assumption. It's better than having a wrong view or one of the three kinds of doubt. But we can see it's not stable. Yeah. Okay. So this is important, you know, to assess our own understandings. And that prevents us from getting arrogant and kind of full of ourselves. Because if we get arrogant over our wise mouth, then definitely the mind that lies behind that mouth is not going to get any wiser. Okay. Okay, so that's the first, correctly assuming consciousness. Second one, a correctly assuming consciousness that has not really ascertained the reason, like an awareness that thinks sound is impermanent, based on the sign of being a product, but without having yet ascertained that sound is a product and that whatever is a product is necessarily impermanent. Okay, so this person again, you know, the first person just believed it without any reason at all. This person has a reason. It's a correct reason, but they don't understand the reason because they haven't understood the three criteria for ascertaining a correct syllogism. OK? Okay. Even though they, I'm sure they know the words of the correct syllogism. Yeah, we can all say it. Yes, there's agreement between the subject and the predicate because sound is a product. For example, you can see, you know, your cell phone makes it. Yeah, it's a product. You know, if it's a product, then it must be impermanent. Yeah, why? Yeah, because, you know, if it's a product, it has causal energy, causal run energy runs out, the product runs out. You know, so you have those things. But, you know, then when your phone breaks, you freak out. Because that phone was not supposed to be impermanent. It was supposed to be permanent. Yeah. So here we can really see that, you know, how our daily behavior indicates what we've understood of what we've studied. Yeah? And so that's why at the Abbey we talk about so much that how our relationships with other people and how we work together as a community is part of our practice, because it's through that that we can see for ourselves how our practice is going. Yeah? And where we hold wrong ideas, where we have doubt, where we have correct assumption, but we haven't really understood it, because when push comes to shove, we just fall back on our old behavior. Hmm? Anybody have that problem? Yeah? Yeah. Anger is a destructive mental state. It sends us to the lower realm. Yeah. Why did you put the spatula there? It doesn't belong there. What's wrong with you? You know? Yeah, this is... Okay. So I think that's, you know, one of the benefits, painful benefits of living with other people is that you get to test what you've understood and you haven't understood. Yeah. When you only live with the people that you like, who say nice things about you, then you don't have the opportunity to test. Okay. So we should be thanking people who help us realize our wrong consciousnesses, our doubts, and our correct assumptions, even though we don't want to admit that we have them. Because what I believe is right by the reason that I believe it. Okay, and three, a correctly assuming consciousness depends on a faulty reason, like an awareness that thinks sound is impermanent, from the sign of being an object of comprehension. And there's no privation there. Yeah? If something is an object of comprehension, it's not necessarily impermanent. Why?
Because permanent things are also objects of comprehension.
For example?
Non-cow.
Who understands non-cow?
Okay, how about emptiness? It can be an object of comprehension.
It better be.
But not for a lot of us, but it will be.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The emptiness, yeah, is non-cow.
Right. Okay. So this is interesting, you know, again, to look at what our belief is and see, you know, what things do we believe just because of no particular reason it sounds good, or our friends believe it. You know, peer pressure. How many things do we believe because of peer pressure? That's a good question to ask ourselves. Yeah, how many things do we believe just because the people we hang out with believe those things? Okay. Yeah?
What about people believing the Mount Meru?
Yeah, what do you think?
I was thinking that you don't need to have a correct belief in correct belief in it to realize emptiness.
You don't need to have a correct belief in Mount Meru to realize emptiness. So somebody could think that Mount Meru exists and still realize emptiness. Probably. Yeah. But would they be able to become an arhat or a Buddha with the belief that Mount Meru exists? Definitely not a Buddha. Arhat? Maybe. You think you can become a Buddha and think Mount Meru exists?
I think if you're a Kala Chakra practitioner, you're imagining Mount Meru exists. So,
but imagining Mount Meru exists and believing Mount Meru exists are two different things.
Okay, the conceptual appearance of Mount Meru exists in your meditation.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean Mount Meru exists.
How do you define Mount Meru?
Well, it's the mountain that's in the center of the universe, and there's four continents around it and eight subcontinents, and you have all the things in the mandala offering. Yeah, and what has His Holiness said about Mount Meru? Yeah, he doesn't believe it exists. Okay, now, so then the question comes, okay, how His Holiness doesn't believe Mount Meru exists, and he doesn't believe the structure of the universe exists as, you know, the old Indian tradition is. But when he does Kala Chakra practice, he imagines all that. So is he involved in wrong consciousnesses?
Maybe it's just skillful means when he says that he doesn't believe Mount Meru exists.
Oh, so you think he's lying?
No, skillful means he's not lying. The Buddha is not lying when he says that, yeah. You know.
Okay, so you really believe that Mount Meru exists too?
I really believe that I don't know.
Okay, good. Good for you. I don't. Okay, because when you're meditating, yeah, you don't have to believe that your object of meditation is actually a real conventional object. Because they talk about when you do the meditation on bones, you know, when you're doing the mindfulness of the body and you imagine that your flesh comes out and there's just your bones and the bones, multiply and multiply until the whole universe is full of bones. And they say that that's, clearly the whole universe isn't full of bones. Yeah. But they say that that is an appearance to the mind. It's not a wrong conception. It's not a wrong consciousness. It's an appearance developed through the power of meditation. And it's helpful to the meditator. So the meditator can still do that meditation, but not believe that there's objective, you know, that when they open their eyes after the meditation, that, you know, they're surrounded by bones. Okay. So there's lots of things. You know, when they teach in Tantra that the guru is the Buddha, they say don't take that on the debating ground because you can't prove it through inference. And that it doesn't really matter if your guru is a Buddha or not in Tantra. What matters is that you think of that guru as the Buddha when you're doing the tantric practice. When you're doing the tantric practice, yeah, His Holiness says, you know, that because he had two gurus who were fighting each other. Yeah. His two, you know, his two senior teachers, Retting Rinpoche and what's the other one? Retting Rinpoche and God, I can't remember names anymore. Anyway, the second one, it wasn't Ling Rinpoche and Shichung Rinpoche, it wasn't those. It was Retting Rinpoche and Tathar Rinpoche. Okay? So those two were fighting each other. You know, or at least their attendants were fighting each other, involved with Sera Monastery and the central government of Tibet were fighting each other. And His Holiness said, when I did my meditation, I saw my two teachers in the context of my meditation. I had only respect for them. They were like Buddhas to me. But when I had to deal with the practical aspects of running the Tibetan government, I told them what they're doing is wrong. He told his teachers that. Okay. So then, yeah, then we go, well, then, you know, he didn't really believe his teachers were the Buddha. If he really believed his teachers were the Buddha, he would have thought it was, you know, Hayagriva and Yamantaka dancing instead of, you know, people fighting each other. That's not what His Holiness said. Okay? So, you know, the thing is, you know, we have to understand when we're meditating kind of what the purpose of imagining certain things is. Yeah. Okay? Even, I mean, not this pertains to Tantra, but it also pertains to Sutra. When we're meditating on the four mindfulnesses, for example, the mindfulness of the body, when you imagine that your body is a decaying corpse, does that mean your body has become a decaying corpse? No. Okay. Does imagining your body like that help you? You bet. Yeah, it gets rid of a lot of your attachment. Do we need to believe in Mount Meru in order to do the mandala offering? When we're sitting there, you know, this ground, anointed, you know, Mount Meru, the four continents, sun and moon. Okay? Does that mean that you're lying when you're offering those to the Buddha? You know, I'm offering Mount Meru and the sun and the moon and the four continents and, you know, the queen and the minister and the horse and the elephant and all those things. You know, am I lying when I'm offering those to the Buddha? Am I being totally fake? Yeah, what a cheap offering. I'm offering the Buddha something that doesn't exist, that I don't even believe exists. You know? Wow, this is good. I don't have to spend any money and I still get merit. You know? Am I lying? Is this just a hoax? Okay. So think about it. Yeah, think about it. Okay. Yeah, there's lots of situations in our practice, you know, that it's very skillful to imagine certain things. You know, but that doesn't mean that those things are conventional things right there, right then and there. When you visualize Chenrezig, is your visualization actually Chenrezig? Correctly assuming consciousnesses are 3P with consciousnesses. Consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing objects. Mental consciousnesses and conceptual consciousnesses. they are mutually exclusive with sense consciousnesses and non-conceptual consciousnesses. Okay? So, correctly assuming consciousnesses, are they mistaken with regard to their appearing objects? Mm-hmm. Yeah, why? Because it's a conceptual appearance. So even though they may see the object correctly, because it's through the veil of a conceptual appearance, it's still mistaken with regard to its appearing object. Okay. For this sort of consciousness, what you believe is true, but the thought is reversible because it does not have the stability of real knowledge, which you would never abandon as long as you remember. I like that qualification, as long as you remember, because you can have the correct knowledge and then forget why you believe it. I suppose that in this day and age, we have to wonder if what we see in media sources counts as experience of something factual or not, in the sense of the specification and the definition that a correctly assuming consciousness has not actually eliminated superimposition, independence on the power of experience. Interesting to think about that. Yeah, if you see a video of something, because now, you know, we're seeing videos of all sorts of things that are going on, does it eliminate through the power of experience any superimpositions? Is watching a video an infallible way to gain understanding? It's not infallible, is it? It's helpful. It's helpful. But the angle at which the video's taken, yeah, how it's edited, all these things can influence how we understand it. But it definitely is helpful. And like in a court of law, I think these videos should be admitted, you know, because they're often much more reliable than people's memory. Yeah. And especially, unfortunately, nowadays, how some police reports are written. Clearly, much of what we see in movies and television and television shows is not real. If you see a man morph into an elephant, that is not real. However, what about the news reports we see? There, too, much of what we see and hear should not be taken as we first imagine. And we add on superimpositions in regard to the images and words. However, it seems to me that if we are seeing the same images over and over, and it is really rational to think that there could be a conspiracy so complete and so broad that the images and news reports are a ruse, perhaps what we are seeing is at least sometimes experience of something factual. This consideration is pressing. Okay, let's read that again. Okay, so if you see a person morph into an elephant, that is not real. Okay, we all agree. Okay, what about the news reports? Yeah, there too, much of what we see and hear should not be taken as we first imagine. And we add on superimpositions in regard to the images and words. Okay, an example of this is, you know, how the news reports different things. And I was talking with somebody today, and they were pointing out that in terms of racism, you know, what you see on the news can really reinforce racist ideas. Yeah, because if the news only reports people of a certain race or religion, only when they're acting as terrorists or criminals, then everybody gets the idea that everybody from that race or religion or ethnic group is a terrorist or a criminal. Yeah? And so that's simply because that's the only image that we've ever seen, or that's the predominant image that we've seen. So it's amazing how, you know, when something is repeated, even though it's false, we tend to believe it simply because it's been repeated so much and we've seen it so much. Okay? So that problem, I mean, okay, the media, maybe it reports on things that get people worked up. It doesn't report on good things. But the problem of believing, you know, creating images of certain groups through what we see on the media and believing our self-created images are accurate, that's our problem. Yeah, that we're not slowing down and really being discerning enough and really saying, is it actually like this? Yeah. Okay, so we add on superimpositions in regard to the images and words. So, you know, when you read a story that is concordant with what you believe, then we add a few extra details to the story when we tell our friends. When we read a story in the news about something that we disagree with, then we often negate the good things that are there and add on some misunderstandings, you know, and impute wrong motivations. Yeah, so if you decide that you don't like a certain social figure or well-known figure, then everything that person says, yeah, we're skeptical of, and everything they do, we criticize. Whereas if it's some party or positions that we like, then everything they do is right, and we believe it, and we repeat it. Now, again, that's our problem, isn't it? We're not really thinking critically enough. And yet it's really difficult nowadays, yeah, when there's so many news channels, and even you have, you know, like there's some news channels that won't write about something unless it's corroborated, you know? But even if it's corroborated, you know, by more than one person, still is how it's written giving the whole story of what it is. Yeah, and so we see one little part or one little parcel, impute the rest of it.
When I was working for Child Protective Services in Sacramento, there were several investigative stories about Child Protective Services and some of the cases that had gone wrong. And the reporter had actually taken transcripts from court and looked at some case history. And even after doing all that, the story that was presented was still not 100% accurate. Mm-hmm. So, we knew it from our side because we had firsthand experience of what was going on, and we could see all the places where that person made the wrong connections, the wrong conclusions, even the wrong facts. Mm-hmm. And so I've since become more skeptical as to what I see on the news because I know they can, in fact, get it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've had any dealing with reporters, you know that things that get written are often very different than what you said, yeah, or what happened. Okay. Then he says, however, it seems to me that if we are seeing the same images over and over, Okay, so there he's assuming that seeing the same thing over and over is true. Okay. And it is not really rational to think that there could be a conspiracy so complete and so broad that the images in the news reports are a ruse. Okay. Perhaps what we are seeing is at least sometimes experience of something factual. Okay. So if you add enough perhaps sometimes in there, that, you know, that could be true. And I think, you know, when he says it's not really rational to think that there could be a conspiracy so complete and so broad that, you know, everything you're seeing is totally wrong. But then there are people who believe that. Yeah? You know, and there's a lot of those people out, and they're gaining more of a platform now, so that almost anything that happens is, you know, the conspiracy of the deep state or, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult. Yeah? If your country has a free press, if your country doesn't have a free press, how free is the press? The free may be, press may be free from government restriction, but is it free from people's crazy ideas? Yeah. Okay. But we have to believe something at some point, don't we? You know, when we go to vote, we have to have some idea of what we're doing, so we have to take something as true. So hopefully what we're taking as true is a correct assumption. Yeah. And there aren't, you know, little green men who are plotting how to take over the world. Okay.
There are men plotting how to take over the world.
There's what?
There are men plotting how to
take over the world. Yeah, there are men. Right. They're just not little green. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, so that's it for this evening. And come back next week and see if you believe the same things next week that you believe this week. Yeah. But be aware of, you know, what you believe and, you know, what is actually true. And, yeah, what, you know, where we have added superimpositions and where we believe other people's stories in which they've added superimpositions or deprecations.